Welcome to NPR's movie podcast, featuring the best of our movie coverage for this week. This time, we look forward with a preview of fall movies that hope to generate Oscar buzz and box office gold, a look back at the tumultuous year, 1968, on the big screen, and two films that will raise your temperature while sitting in your seat. But first, you may not know his name, but you certainly knew his voice.
This summer, between honor and dishonor, between family and enemies.
Rolling Stone says seeing it once is just not enough.
High five.
Indiana Jones is on the quest of a lifetime.
Don LaFontaine, the voice of more than 5,000 movie trailers, died Monday at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. He was 68 years old. Over three decades behind the microphone, LaFontaine turned trailers into cinematic events. Here he is poking fun at himself in a recent commercial for Geico car insurance.
When the storm hit, both our cars were totally underwater.
In a world where both of our cars were totally underwater,
we thought it would take forever to get some help.
But a new wind was about to blow.
Nobody could say it better than Don LaFontaine. It's that time when fall films start coming out, the serious ones hoping to score the perfect combination of Oscar buzz and box office gold. Bob Mondello has this selective preview of what's in store for the fall.
Oscar season looming, and oh, the drama, epics, westerns, war movies, and that masterpiece theater sensibility in the 18th century melodrama,
The Duchess of Devonshire.
Keira Knightley is a British aristocrat who dabbles in politics.
How's the campaign going?
Terribly.
Perhaps we could use my ability to draw attention to our advantage.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mr. Charles Grey.
Change is upon us. We shall.
One thing that change apparently doesn't affect is campaign rhetoric. Other films with a political bent this fall include Milk, the real-life tragedy of assassinated gay leader Harvey Milk, played by Sean Penn, and director Oliver Stone, who's explored the legacies of past presidents in his films JFK and Nixon, offers a comic portrait of a sitting president in W.
Parting, chasing tail, driving drunk.
I got it.
Who do you think you are?
A Kennedy?
You're a Bush. Act like one.
While Oliver Stone skewers a political dynasty, director Barry Levinson will skewer Hollywood in What Just Happened, with talent agent Robert De Niro fending off daily catastrophe.
Talk to me.
You're not going to believe it. He's fat.
Bruce Willis is overweight?
With a Grizzly Adams beard.
Audiences want to know it's you, Bruce.
What are you talking about? They're not going to recognize me, Ben? Oh, where'd Bruce go? Oh, look, there he is. I see him right there, the guy with the beard.
Credit Willis with being a good sport. Other fall comedies include an updated remake of the 1930s backbiting sensation, The Women, without Claire Booth Luce's dialogue, which seems a shame, but with a cast that includes Meg Ryan, Jada Pinkett Smith, Bette Midler, and Candice Bergen.
I heard what happened. I ordered you a gimlet. I know you don't drink in the afternoon, but you will eventually, so why not start now?
Also going for laughs are the Coen brothers, who appear to be in a Fargo frame of mind with their CIA versus gym rats comedy, Burn After Reading, and British director Mike Leigh, whose happy-go-lucky is about a woman so relentlessly cheerful, she's almost alarming.
Have you ever had a driving lesson before?
Yeah. No, wasn't really a lesson.
You know, you can make jokes while you're driving, but you will crash and you will die laughing.
Well, if you're gonna go, that's the best way to go, I suppose.
Happy-Go-Lucky has been getting rapturous reviews in Europe. The word is more mixed on Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York, but the concept's pretty cool. It's about a theater director who tries to recreate Manhattan life-size in a warehouse. Word is that director Jonathan Demme is in peak form with his domestic drama, Rachel Getting Married, about a family's black sheep returning to the fold. And Spike Lee will have an intriguing change of pace with Miracle at St. Anna. A World War II drama in which black soldiers get separated from their unit after one of them risks his life to save a child.
American.
We are Italians.
You got a boy that needs help. I don't know how the hell we got past German lines, but we're surrounded.
You ain't got to be scared. Feel that magic.
All you got to do is believe in it.
World War II's Pacific Front is represented in Baz Luhrmann's sweeping epic, Australia, starring the Down Under stars Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman, and another Australian actor, Russell Crowe, will play a duplicitous American in a more current war, battling Al-Qaeda with Leo DiCaprio in Body of Lies.
A global war requires constant diligence in order to suppress. Allegedly unsophisticated enemy has realized that we are an easy target. Our world is a lot simpler to put to an end than you might think.
That's a sentiment that will be borne out rather literally in a series of cinematic apocalypses. A plague darkens humanity's outlook in blindness.
What's the matter?
I can't see. Somehow that patient infected me.
That's impossible. Nobody goes blind like that.
Good morning, Minister. Some strange calls this morning.
My fellow citizens, like so many of you, I have gone blind.
And if that isn't sufficiently apocalyptic, there's Cormac McCarthy's The Road, in which a father trudges with his young son across an America that can no longer sustain life. And if you prefer your apocalypse now, well, what better evidence could there be of the end of life as we know it than High School Musical 3?
Right now I can hardly breathe.
Oh, you can do it, just know that I believe.
More down-to-earth teenagers inhabit the romantic comedy Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, played by Michael Cera and Kat Dennings, fresh-faced stars in a season with lots of star turns. Jamie Foxx as a homeless musical prodigy in The Soloist, Greg Kinnear as an abused inventor in Flash of Genius, Viggo Mortensen and Ed Harris as Western lawmen in Appaloosa, and Angelina Jolie as the distressed mother of a kidnapped child in The Changeling.
Well, aren't you gonna...
That's not my son.
Well, I'm sure you're mistaken.
I'm not mistaken.
Well, he's been through 5 terrible long months. He's lost weight. He's changed.
I would know my own son.
With quite a few children in peril at the multiplex this fall, it's probably a good thing that there are also films for children. Talking Pooches in Beverly Hills Chihuahua, animated lions, zebras, and hippos in Madagascar Escape to Africa, and an animated superhero puppy who doesn't know he's just an actor in Bolt.
You'll never see Penny again!
And cut!
Oh, don't let him out! He's never been off the set before!
I'm coming, Penny!
Production of the hit television show Bolt shut down today when its star dog went missing.
Kid pictures generally make big bucks in the fall, but they're unlikely to best the season's one guaranteed blockbuster, headed by a hero who's also gone missing, as it happens, in an adventure that picks up just moments after we last saw him in Casino Royale. We're talking 007.
Restrict Bond's movements. Put a stop on his passport. Find Bond.
How long have I got?
30 seconds.
That doesn't give us a lot of time.
The title is Quantum of Solace, a mouthful, but the producers promise more gadgets, more gorgeous women, more Daniel Craig, and more of the original theme music that the last 007 movie was so short on. Can you wait? I'm Bob Mondello.
We've been spending part of this year remembering one of the most tumultuous years in our history, 1968, 40 years ago. It was the year of the murders of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. It was a year of riots and anti-war protests. There were also cultural upheavals, which were visible on the silver screen. And that's our subject in the latest report in our series, Echoes of 1968. Here's NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg.
The 1968 Academy Awards ceremony was postponed for 2 days because of Martin Luther King's assassination. When the time came to name the Oscar winner for Best Picture, the list included films with lines that have lasted low these many years.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
The Graduate, directed by Mike Nichols, a film that defined generation gap.
This year's Miss Bonnie Parker.
Glad to meet you.
I'm Clyde Barrow.
Clyde.
We rob banks.
Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, a folk tale of Depression-era robbery and bloodshed.
And it never occurred to me that I might fall in love with a Negro, but I did.
and nothing in the world is going to change that.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, directed by Stanley Kramer. Interracial marriage in a liberal and patrician white family.
Virgil, that's a funny name for a nigger boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
In the Heat of the Night, directed by Norman Jewison, about racial tensions and murder in a small Mississippi town. Oh, yes, and this one.
It's incredible. It's impossible. But it's true. A man can talk to the animals.
Dr. Doolittle, directed by Richard Fleischer, about, you know. And the Oscar went to In the Heat of the Night. In many ways, the tamest film of the bunch. Other Best Picture nominees were hotter, bolder. In a book about 60s movie making, Mark Harris says Hollywood then mostly meant World War II stories, westerns, and epics. So some of those new films were revolutionary.
I think the revolution was that movies finally started to catch up with what was going on in the culture at large.
Civil rights were much on people's minds in the late 60s, more so than the Vietnam War, at least in movie theaters. And Heat of the Night was about race as well as whodunit. But in his book, Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, Mark Harris says the real competition that 1968 Oscar night was for the future of movie making.
I think there was a general sense that Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate were going to be more lasting achievements than In the Heat of the Night, which was, I think, seen as a very skillful, traditional Hollywood mystery with a good liberal message in it.
Bonnie and Clyde was revolutionary, influenced by a new wave of gritty, realistic foreign films. Audiences fell in love with the gorgeous protagonists, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway playing Robin Hoods, whose Robin ways end in a shockingly prolonged volley of bullets. Their first holdup is a farce.
They go into the bank. They say,
"Is this a stick-up?"
Nobody hears them. So they have to say it louder and get everybody's attention.
"Yes, there's a stick-up!"
Meanwhile, their inept getaway driver is trying to parallel park the getaway car. But when they come out of the bank with all the money to make their getaway, they don't know where he's parked.
"Hi, where's the car?"
When they finally get into the car, you're laughing. Then the bank manager jumps onto the rear windshield.
Clyde turns around and shoots him, and you see the bullet go through the windshield and the lens of his eyeglasses, and his face explodes in blood.
Bang, the laughter stops. The movie goes ugly and disoriented. Bang, a new kind of filmmaking. Mark Harris says The Graduate, another Best Picture nominee at the 1968 Oscar ceremonies, was revolutionary in several ways.
The Graduate, perhaps more than any of the five movies, really did change things because, if nothing else, it was the biggest hit of the five. In fact, by the end of its run, which was, I think, two full years in theaters, it was the third highest grossing movie in history.
Upper middle class L.A., disaffected college grad seduced by older woman falls in love with her daughter, sure. But here's the revolution. The story is told from a new point of view.
Suddenly, the kind of camera had shifted, and this was looking at the generation gap now from the other side of the generation gap, from the young side.
And there's more. Young people raced to see The Graduate. Hollywood discovered a new audience.
And that was who movies started to get made for after that.
"Have you thought about graduate school?"
"No."
"Would you mind telling me then what those 4 years of college were for? What was the point of all that hard work?"
"You got me."
"Have you given any thought to the problems your children are going to have?"
"Yes, and they'll have some."
Sidney Poitier and Spencer Tracy in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
"Is that the way Joey feels?"
"She feels that every single one of our children will be president of the United States, and they'll all have colorful administrations."
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner almost didn't get made. Here's how the director's widow tells the story. Karen Kramer says Hollywood wasn't ready for a film about interracial marriage. The topic, in certain places in America then, was taboo and illegal, and Stanley Kramer knew it.
"He was afraid to tell Columbia Pictures what the subject matter was completely about because, look, as an investment for Columbia Pictures, it can't play in 16 states in this country or it would cause riots. It's not a good investment for a studio." So he would tap dance his way out of giving them the screenplay. And he said, "Look, I've got Spencer Tracy, I've got Catherine Hepburn, I've got Sidney Poitier, and it's a love story." Well, is it not a love story? It is a love story. But he didn't want to give them the script because he knew that they would have objections to it.
Eventually, according to Karen Kramer, her husband had no choice. He handed over the script. The film was canceled. Columbia claimed they were worried about Spencer Tracy's health. He'd been ill for many years. Stanley Kramer felt that was a cover. He had an idea. The director and his wife went to see Katharine Hepburn.
And he said, Kate, look it. I'm going to put up my salary as collateral for this film. And will you do the same? And she said, are you serious? He said, yes. And she said, I will too.
The film got made. Months before Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was released, the Supreme Court said laws forbidding miscegenation were unconstitutional. And Karen Kramer says real life helped the film in another way.
Dean Rusk, who was Secretary of State in 1968's daughter, married another Stanford student who just happened to be black. It made the front page in every newspaper in this country.
In the summer of 1968, the Beatles sang about revolution. But even before that, a revolution in movie making was playing on the silver screens of America. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You can find scenes from those Best Picture nominees at NPR.org.
Two new films out now that each have their own take on sensuality and desire. Film critic Dessen Thompson joins us. Dessen, thanks for being with us.
It's always a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you.
Dim the lights a little. We get to talk about two Penelope Cruz films. Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which, of course, is written and directed by Woody Allen, and then Elegy, based on the Philip Roth novel The Dying Animal.
Yes, it's a double for her.
Yes.
And a double for us.
Yes, indeed. Well, all right, let's not linger over that. The first is a comedy, and the second is a drama. Tell us what you see in each.
Both movies are fun, even though Elegy is quite depressing in many ways. There's a sort of a fun aspect to it for us all, because we get to see men and women in close contact, and I don't just mean physically, but mm-hmm. I mean their souls come up against each other as well. So it's a sort of an enjoyable front-end collision of man and woman and all the problems that bounce therein.
Tell us a little about Vicky Cristina Barcelona. There's been a lot of publicity attached to this film because it's a Woody Allen film, after
yeah.
all.
Well, two American friends, women friends, find themselves in Barcelona, and a very charming, stubbled, sexy Spanish gentleman approaches them in the restaurant and forthrightly asks them if they would like to sleep with him simultaneously. They're absolutely appalled by it and yet intrigued.
Oh, right. You're asking us to fly to Oviedo and back.
No, we'll spend the weekend. I mean, I'll show you around the city and we'll eat well, we'll drink good wine, we'll make love.
Yeah, who exactly is going to make love?
Hopefully the three of us.
And from there, the woman who is going for it is Scarlett Johansson. She's quite seduced by the idea, but her friend, played by Rebecca Hall, is less enthused because she's about to be married to somebody who turns out to be a rather boring 9-to-5 guy in America. And so over the course of the movie, we see what happens.
Elegy, there's some poignance just in the setup. An older male character played by Ben Kingsley, I gather, becomes obsessed.
Yes, he meets a student.
Penelope Cruz.
In her late 20s. He's in his 60s. But in many movies where old men become infatuated with women, what starts out as an object of desire turns to love. The compartmentalization that men are notorious for breaks down and love seeps in. And so this is where we become really intrigued in the story.
What do you really want from me?
What do I really want from you?
Mm-hmm. You spend your whole life going through relationships without ever really bonding with anyone. So at least I would like to know who I am for you.
Are these movies in any way, I don't want to say opposed necessarily, but it strikes me, and I haven't seen either, that one of them is saying, you know, look, sex is fun and can be just fun. And the other is saying, no, it crosses a line pretty early on.
It's saying that sex is all of those things. It's saying that sex is the subject that consumes all of us, and which the movies, especially in Hollywood, have sort of made us curtail our discussion of. European movies have no compunction talking about sex as a pure and easy subject that exists in all of our minds. But on the Hollywood screen, we sort of have to excuse the fact that we're talking about sex. So I enjoyed the fact that sex is allowed to just join the other subjects of life,
mm-hmm.
And especially sex that isn't involving people in their 20s or their teens.
Yet, of course, Vicky Cristina Barcelona,
yes.
I suppose I should say, is made by Woody Allen, a man who is, how do I say this nicely, his real-life experiences would seem to harmonize with the second film.
This is what is intriguing about this subject, is that sex is comedy and it's tragedy and it's many things.
I think Ben Kingsley is pound for pound maybe the best actor in the English-speaking world. What's his performance like?
Oh, he's absolutely brilliant. It takes someone like that to be in that role because, think about it. If you've got a 60-year-old man lusting for a woman in her late 20s, he's already portrayed in a bad corner. So when you've got someone like Ben Kingsley, it humanizes things and we start to really be with him. And he's no wonderful character either. He goes through life thinking that sex is all that he's interested in, but in meeting her, he falls in love. This is kind of what happens to all men who think that sex is all there is to sex in the movies. What movie audiences look for are boundary breaking. They want to see special effects, so they want to see reality being shattered. They want to see people suddenly ascending into the air or having superheroic power. But in these films, like Love, the boundaries are being broken too. People are discovering things about themselves in the bedroom, and not just sexual things, but I'm talking about discoveries about themselves. So boundary breaking is going on in both types of movies. So if people thought about it, they should enjoy both types, I think.
Film critic Dessen Thompson. Dessen, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.